our staff. We have invited the select committee to please ask, so it's a joint committee today to receive a presentation. As you know that we are considering the two ESCOM bills, and we have agreed that we should have public hearings today. And we do have responses, so we'll go through those presentations. The first presentation will be from Mr. Torres Bishop Mills from the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. Once we've gotten that input, we'll allow members to comment or ask questions, then we'll release them, and then we'll then get the next presentation from the University of Cape Town by Mr. Hilton Troy, and then we'll also allow for declarations. And then after that is the Cape Peninsula University of Technology and Mr. Rob Jeffrey from Econometrics. That will be a joint presentation. That is by Professor Philip Lloyd from Energy Institute of the Cape Peninsula University, and then Mr. Rob Jeffrey from Econometrics. They'll do a joint presentation, then we'll have deliberations, and that will be the end of our presentation. We've planned up to 12 if we finish earlier, but all that we want to allow members enough time to interrogate the presentations. So thank you very much. You are welcome. We'll start with Mr. Tobias. You have the floor. Just press some of them. Okay.
Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable committee members. Thank you very much for having me here and giving the opportunity to present to you a few slides on what we see the financial aspects of the power system expansion. Maybe just a few words about myself so that you know where I'm coming from. Before I joined the CFR last year to lead the establishment of an integrated energy research center, I was for 2 years with ESCOM in the energy planning unit, was part of the team that developed the IRP 2010 and was working on the IRP update. So from that perspective, I have the background of the long-term effects on the power system planning. Now, in terms of the presentation today, I thought I'd give you, in the first chapter, without digging into the details of the two ESCOM bills, but giving some perspective on the financial aspects in the power system in the long term in general. Then I will talk about the electricity tariff and the cost of new bills and how that relates to each other, and then two slides on specific ESCOM considerations. Let's start first of all with the long-term aspects. I would like to start with highlighting what you've seen during the last 3 to 4 years basically as the cost reduction path of the two mainstream renewable technologies, solar PV and wind, in South Africa. So what you see here are actual numbers, actual tariffs, and they are not from somewhere where it might or might not be applicable to South Africa, but these are South African numbers, these are the tariffs. The tariff results of the first 4 bid windows of the competitive tender process that the Department of Energy runs to procure renewable energies, and now expanded that process also to coal and gas. But these are the results for solar PV and wind. What you see on the solar side, that it's all normalized to April 2014 rent to make it comparable. On the solar PV side, it started in November 2011. That's when the first bid window was submitted by the bidders with 3.30, and now in between 2004, that is August last year, the bid submission was less than 3 years after the first bid window at 79 cents, which is more than 75% less than the first bid window. Similar, but not as deep on the wind side, starting with 1.36, now at 62 cents, more than 50% cost reduction. Now, what that means is these numbers all have to be put into respect and have to be put into some relation. Otherwise, they are hanging somewhere in the open space. So, on that slide, we first would like to put them into comparison to what coal and gas new build options cost. We'll have a slide on that later. Coal is a baseload coal-fired power station costs you anything between 80 cents and above. gas is around 1 rand per kilowatt hour. So from that very high level comparison, without looking into any system effect and how you bring the different mixes together, you can already see that we've achieved cost competitiveness of these renewable technologies. Now, just one slide to explain or to highlight the general IRP process and how that works in principle. We have in the planning simulation, well, that's basically what ESCOM does on behalf of the Department of Energy. That's the team where I was part of. Have in the planning simulation world, at the core of that process, you have your IRP model, which is, mathematically speaking, a mathematical least cost optimization model. So that model tries to find with the inputs that go into the model, which are mainly your demand forecast, it's a very important input, but also your technology cost and performance assumptions for the different supply options is also an important input that goes into that model. And the output is then what we know as the IRP, it's the capacity expansion plan until 2030. Now that is the simulation world, kind of the planning world. Now that is connected to the actual, to the real world by the Department of Energy taking this capacity expansion plan as input into their competitive tender process to procure these capacities as they were modeled in the IRP. Now that's the process that we observe at the moment, and at the competitive tender process, the outcomes of that are now your preferred bidders, megawatt allocation, but very important, or more, probably most importantly, we now have technology actual costs as compared to technology cost assumptions that go into the IRP as an input. And now that link from outcomes of the real world, the actual tariffs that are being paid, to the inputs into the IRP model, that's a feedback loop that is now currently being established, so that now that we have more and more numbers coming in from the actual, from the real world, now we need to close that loop and bring it back into the IRP. Now we have the renewable coming online, but we also have a coal and a gas tender coming soon, so as soon as these tariffs come back, we have to use these actual tariffs and put them back into the IRP model to strengthen that whole process. Now that feedback loop is a dot line because it's not institutionalized yet, but we think it's important to have that. For the first project that now came online, we've basically started doing that feedback loop. So what we see here is the comparison for solar PV, the comparison of the first four bid windows tariff results, as we have seen it on the previous slide. So these are the red dots. These are the actual tariffs. In the fourth bid window, it was 79 cents per kilowatt hour. And compared to that, you see these two black curves are the low and the high cost assumption in the IRP 2010. And you see on the solar PV side that the first and the second bid window, especially the first one, was probably not overly competitive yet. There was a lot of learning in that process that was sort of quite a high tariff. But with the second already, it approaches this funnel of cost assumptions that went into the IRP. And now fourth bid window is significantly below the cost assumptions that went into the least cost optimization IRP model. So just to calibrate how the simulation world now actually links to the results of the actual world, to give comfort that the simulation world did something right, basically. Now on the wind side, it's actually more dramatic than on the PV side. You also have this cost reduction. And now the third bid window results were already at the level of what the cost assumption was for wind in 2030. And bid window 4 is significantly below that. So especially on the wind side, that's an important part of the feedback loop to feed the actual real cost of wind back into the IRP simulation model. Now if you compare these actual results as you see them on the left-hand side, the 79 or 80 cents for PE and 60 cents for wind, these are the renewables actual results as per costs, as per bid window 4, compare them to alternative new build options that we have, conventional new build options on the right-hand side, you see that the cost of these two renewables are now on par with alternative new build options. And I want to highlight this slide before we go into the next chapter, because it's important that we see that any new build option comes at a certain price tag, and they are basically all more or less in the same price range now, between 60 cents coming from wind, being now the cheapest new build option that we have in the country, over 80 cents for PV, for baseload coal, up to, if you look at mid-merit coal, if the load factor of the coal-fired power power station is not 85 but only 50%, then the costs go up to 120. These are kind of the range of new build options we have. And on that, we don't have actual numbers yet for the numbers on the right-hand side. These are the assumptions as per the IFE model, just adjusted to April 2014 rent to make it comparable. But otherwise, on the right-hand side, these costs will need to be updated as soon as we have results from the competitive tender process as well to make them even better comparable to the left-hand side, which is the actual. Now, what we have done at the CSR Energy Center, now that we have the first renewables online, we wanted to this comparison of these levelized costs and tariffs to some extent falls flat, because obviously wind is fluctuating, PV, solar PV is also fluctuating, only produced during the day. So we want to quantify what, taking into account these specifics of these two technologies, what was the actual value and cost to the power system in 2014 of the first renewables that came online. So in 2014, what you see here is a ramp up of these capacities. We are looking here at the energy that was produced month on month from wind and solar in the year 2014. So you see that as the project, it was more than 30 individual projects that came online during 2014. As they came online, they produced more and more energy per month. In steady state, which in December last year, we had 340 gigawatt hours per year being produced. That's now at the moment more or less the level that the renewables produce, 350 to 400 gigawatt hours per year, which means they contribute now, as we speak, around about 2% to our total electricity demand. And we had 600 megawatts of wind installed end of last year and around about 1,000 megawatts of PV installed that produced that energy. Now, if you look at the contribution of these renewables to the overall power system, what you see here is the SAC up for the entire year of 2014 of the typical diurnal courses, so the daily supply profile for different months of the year. The typical January day, a typical February day, and so on and so forth. And you see the stack up goes from, on the lowest level, from nuclear, that is the base supply generator that always runs, to imports and other imports. It's mainly our water, so that's also kind of a base load supplier. Then we have the large coal sheet, the brown stack, and then on the very top we have OCGTs, diesel-driven OCGTs, and you see that is basically indicating that shows you the constrainedness of the system that we have at the moment. These, especially if you look at January 2014, this large amount of diesel being burned on the top of this mountain could actually not have been burned. In a system that is not constrained, you would run the OCGTs not throughout the day, and you wouldn't burn that much diesel. Now, during the year, you can see how in January it was still very low contribution from wind and solar, but if you compare now with December, which is a similar day, also a summer day, now PV and wind is online, and PV it helps to reduce the morning peak, especially in summer days. Now, that is just a qualitative assessment of how the supply profile actually looks like. Now we've developed a methodology to say, well, how can we actually pin that down and quantify what the financial effects were on the system? And we said, well, if we think about it, if solar, PV, and wind is now online, in any given hour of the year, these generators can have one out of these three effects. Either if the hour is an hour where the system is unconstrained, the fact that wind and PV is now there and produces energy reduces the amount of coal that needs to be burned in that hour. That is the first effect that has the lowest value because coal is the cheapest fuel. The second effect is if we are in an hour where the system is constrained, measured by the diesel turbines are already running, in that hour, wind and PV reduce diesel burn, because if they were not there, then the diesel turbines would have to run harder. And there are other hours where the system is so constrained that if you take wind and PV away in that hour, you would actually have to go into so-called unserved energy, which is the curtailment of customer load. Now, that methodology just illustratively explained on specific days. This is an actual day. This is the production and supply profile of the 7th of October last year. And you can see this is a normal day, how it should be. The diesel turbines are almost not running on that day. And you see that this blue line, which is the wind supply, and this yellowish line, which is the PV supply, would you take that away on that day? We assumed that the coal fleet would ramp up and hence these wind and PV generators saved coal fuel. On a more constrained day, if you look at this day, you see this large area, this light area on the very top. This is the diesel that is being burned to keep the light on that day. Now we say, well, during the night, where you see the A, this wind energy still saves coal, because during night we are constrained. You could ramp up the coal fleet to take that energy up. But during the day, the diesel turbines are already running, which means the coal fleet is at its limits. If you take wind and PV away during these hours, you would have to run the diesel turbines harder, which in essence means wind and PV save diesel in these hours. Now the last logic is on such a day, that's the 16th of December last year. You see that the two flexibility sources that we have in the system, which is the OCGTs and which is the hydro and the pumped storage, between 9 o'clock and 1 o'clock, they are all running at their maximum output. If in these hours, in these 4 hours, if the PV fleet had not been there, we would have had to go into customer curtailment, because there is no other lever on the supply side to supply this energy. So that's the effect of reduction of unsaved energy that the renewables had last year. If we put all that together, you see the three effects now quantified in bill and rand, taking the financials from the Eskom financial report for coal and diesel costs and for unsaved energy from the IRP. Now you see that the wind and PV fleet in 2014 saved a total of 3.6 billion of fuel. This actual cash savings for Eskom, so Eskom did not have to spend 3.6 billion because of the renewables. And in addition, we had a macroeconomic effect of 1.7 billion, which is the macroeconomic benefit of not having curtailed customer loads during 117 hours in the last year in 2014. That would have an additional customer curtailment in addition to the load shedding that we had anyway last year. So total financial benefit last year were 5.3 billion. The tariff payments to the independent power producers were 4.5, so that left a net benefit to the economy of 0.8 billion last year. Taking into account that these projects that came online last year in 2014 were the most expensive ones from Bid Window 1, and still they produce a net financial benefit, just indicates what the future pathway will be. Now, with all these cost assumptions in mind, let's go to the second chapter, which is all just one slide, electricity tariffs and cost of renewables. What we are highlighting here is the actual cost breakdown of the electricity operating costs, so the pure operating costs of Eskom, as per the interim financial report from September last year. The electricity operating cost to produce, on average, produce one unit of electricity for Eskom stood at 62 cents per kilowatt hour. And that breaks down roughly into two-thirds is for generation, and the other parts distributed across transmission, so running the transmission lines, distribution, running Eskom's distribution network, and then customer service and other, so billing and metering and everything else. So what that shows is that generation is by far the largest component of the total electricity tariff. But what that also shows, if you take these numbers and now compare them to the cost of new build options, if we put them, and this now is just a selection, it's the same cost that we saw on the previous slide, wind 60 cents, PE 80 cents, baseload coal, a new baseload coal-fired power station 80 cents, mid-merit gas, around about 1 rand per kilowatt hour, all of the new build options, regardless of which one you are looking at, are more expensive than the electricity operating costs. Most of them are actually, all of them are actually more expensive than the pure generation part of Eskom's cost base. What that means is, when we bring new generators online, because of that reality, it's a mathematical reality that the average tariff will have to increase. In everything in real terms, of course, not taking inflation into account, but in real terms, the tariff will have to increase. Or we need additional money from somewhere else, which is part of the discussion today. But it's just want to highlight that this is it's irrespective of what new capacity you build. We need new capacity because the system is constrained. Whatever we build, the effect on the average tariff for a couple of years to come will be an increasing effect. You can basically, on a very high level from these numbers, already make a back-of-envelope calculation of where the average tariff will stabilize, because it will stabilize. It's not some people think the average tariff is on an upward slope that goes exponentially up, like until infinity. It's actually on an S curve, and we are in the last third of that S curve, and it will stabilize. And you can look at it this way: if you look at the mix of new build options on the right hand side, let's say the average new build power station costs us between 8 and 90 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's in the long run, that will be the cost for generation in this breakdown of the cost base of Eskom, 80 to 90 cents. If you add to that the cost for transmission, distribution, and everything else, then we end up at around about 1.10 to 1.20, which is the long-term steady-state tariff that we would have to expect in real terms. Now, specific Eskom considerations. First of all, the appropriations that are being discussed will help Eskom from an, that's obvious from a liquidity position. I just want to highlight a few things here: that the new IPP purchases are not funded under MIPP3 yet. Bitwindow 3.5, which is CFP, and the Bitwindow Hall, which is the low tariffs that we have seen, are not were not included in MIPP3 yet. Cogen, the STPPP extension of the additional extension of Bitwindow 4, and the additional 1,800 megawatts from the expedited program, also not funded under MIPD3, obviously, because they were not even on the radar then. All these costs are generally approved. If Eskom was in a normal situation, that would just be funded and then recovered in the next MIPD round. In the cash constraint that Eskom is in at the moment, it is relevant to know that, because even if these costs are all approved, then Eskom will be able to recover them in the next MIPD round. They pose a challenge from a liquidity perspective. So therefore, the proposed appropriation will release that constraint in terms of liquidity to Eskom, and they will actually allow the tariff increase, which I highlighted on the previous slide, which is a mathematical reality, to be lower than otherwise necessary. And last comment, what is important, I think, in terms of the spending, when you look at where that money goes and what Eskom used the money for, there's obviously for very good reasons, there's a high priority on the maintenance of the existing fleet and on the new build program, which adds new generators to the system. However, the transmission aspects must not be deprioritized. As you saw on the previous slides, the cost of transmission is compared to generation relatively small. It's in the order of 10 to 15% of the total costs. However, transmission investments into transmission infrastructure, into grid infrastructure, are essential as an enabler for new generators and for new customer load or strengthening customer load, which all will have a dampening effect, a lowering effect on the average tariff. So with the not sufficient spending on the transmission side, it's relatively little money that is saved, but it's potentially a lot of harm that can be created in the longer term if the money is not spent appropriately on transmission. As important as the new build program is, spending in grid infrastructure must not be deprioritized. Otherwise, the long-term effect will be non-availability of inexpensive additional power. That mainly speaks to wind power, where the transmission grid needs to go to areas where there's a lot of wind, and suppress sales due to fewer or less load customer connections, which, if you fail less, that also has an increasing effect on the tariff. These were the comments that we would want to make on the discussed bills. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Tobias, Bishop Nims. Any addition? No. Honorable members, any comments on this one? Straightforward? Complex? Confused? Yes.
Sir, are we asking questions for clarity and then disposing of Professor? And we're asking all the questions now? Or are they coming at the end together?
No, they are going to leave. So anything you want to ask, then ask now. Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. Come in, honorable.
On slide 19. Those renewables that are not in the purchases, that are not factored in, how many of the wind farms currently operating, but they're not connected to the grid. And what effect has that got on the system and the supply of electricity? And how, because we believe that Eskom has been paying them. So it's, they're paying for the generation of electricity, but it's not coming into the grid. And I wondered whether you were aware of this. Okay, and thank you. I'll stick with that. Sorry.
Prof, wait a bit. We can just note so that if there are other questions, then you can answer once. Thank you, Honorable Van Lingen. Honorable Yalume.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, on slide number 17, you said any new power generator is more costly than the current cost of generation and will therefore increase the average tariff. I just want to check, is this the new one, is because they are too technological, or why are so expensive? Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Honorable Fick?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. It's a good presentation, a little technical, which makes it difficult to understand for myself. But nevertheless, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, my questions will be related to cost and affordability. So the first question I have is the investment of something like this to supplement over the current electricity needs that we have. What would that be to meet the needs of the country so that we solve our electricity problems? And I know this would probably not be your decision, or because it would be the government's decision, but would private investment be encouraged for something like this, instead of only investment by government, when you talk about investment? When you look at the maintenance costs of some this renewable energy, well, how does that compare the maintenance costs with the current energy that has been used at the moment? And then another question is the lifespan of the type of renewable energy, because obviously one of the reasons why we're in the current situation is because of the lack of maintenance and maintenance costs that we obviously can't afford. So, and you might have dealt with it, but please just elaborate on that. Our needs for electricity in South Africa, there's a lot of need from the rural areas, okay? So would something like this be ideal for supply of electricity to the rural areas, to the far outlying areas? And then maybe the last question, if you'll allow me, Honorable Chairperson, is in terms of the obviously looking for renewable, sustainable energy. So the cost must come into it. Would this type of energy make profit from year one? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Thomas. Thank you, Chairperson. On slide 7, if you could just simplify that in layman's language, does what we see suggest that we are running a rather expensive operation in terms of the kind of energy we use, the diesel and coal? If you look at the last three blocks of that slide, the meat, merit, coal, gas, and diesel, that's what it suggests. Meaning that even nuclear energy would be a lot cheaper than what we're running now. This is what it means. The second clarity I think is on page 17. Your left blocks. It doesn't seem to me that the costs that you are mentioning there are also including the maintenance cost. If it does, well and good. If it doesn't, what would
how would those numbers change if we were to include the current maintenance costs, which are speaking as well to the back law of maintenance, sitting back to pre-1980, for instance. The last question, Chairperson, is probably not part of the... It would be relevant to all the presenters. South Africa is very much mountainous in many parts of the country. And in some instances, putting electricity there, and I link this question to this issue to the earlier question about rural areas. The difficult terrain would make it a bit costly to extend electricity through those mountains. Have we put into our planning that cost factor? And if not, if we were to put that, how much expensive, how much more expensive would our electricity be? And therefore it comes back to the issue of the renewables, which you can easily put into any mountainous area without a lot more cost. The winds, the solar, and so on. Thanks.
Okay. Let me allow them to respond to those first round of questions. I'll take honorable members' thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. So the first question was around wind projects and the deemed energy payments that are paid to wind projects. I don't have the exact numbers for that. There are projects that are waiting for grid connection and get so-called deemed energy payments. But the way it works is that you have an agreed grid connection date. If the IPD, now there are two entities that have to be ready at the agreed grid connection date, which is EFON from the one side, and the IPD obviously has to be ready from the other side as well. If the IPD is ready, and the grid is not there yet at the agreed grid connection date, then that triggers so-called deemed energy payments. What that amount is, I don't know, but I don't have the exact numbers handy at the moment. But what I can tell you is that these payments are relatively small compared to the overall program. The problem that you probably allude to is more the timing of the grid connection when it comes to the actual agreed date. That is more the problem. Where we're talking, especially between Window 3 and between Window 4 projects, they have an agreed grid connection date, especially for wind, because they are in more remote areas, where the agreed grid connection date lies in 2018 or 2019. So it will be helpful when they come online, but it simply takes time to bring the grid there. So the problem is not so much a problem of deemed energy payments. The problem is that the grid is not there yet. And that means the agreed grid connection date is long in the future, and that again means that we will not get the energy for it, but we are not paying for that energy either. So the situation where you really have to have a situation where ECOM has agreed on a certain date to connect, and now they can't deliver. But that typically means 2 months delay, maybe 3 months delay. It doesn't mean like years. The years of delay we have in the actual planning. But then the agreed connection date is also much later. I don't have the exact numbers of how much the deemed energy payments is. I know these numbers are available, but from my experience, I would say that it's probably a few percentage points of the total bill. It's not a significant amount at the moment. The damage of not having this energy early, but speaks to what I highlighted in the slides about the transmission grid, the investment into transmission. Also, it takes a couple of years before you can reap the benefits, but they are very essential and important exactly for that reason, because otherwise you cannot bring the new energy into the system, into the grid. Then the question, why more expensive, was on this side, I believe, if I remember correctly. Well, this is the cost of the new build options. That's what the cost of new build options are, and they are not expensive in global benchmarks. So globally, that's what you have to pay. Actually, wind and solar PV is very cheap in South Africa because of the excellent resources. the other coal and mid-range gas, these are kind of the costs that you will see anywhere in the world. Obviously, it depends on some how good the access to your fuel source mainly, but that's what you have to pay. So we are not, on the right-hand side, these costs are not inflated by any means. We are not paying the premium in that sense. And now the question, why is that then still significantly more expensive than the current cost of generation? The reason for that is twofold. One, in the current generation fleet, we have almost no capital costs in that anymore because they were built many, many years, many decades ago, actually. And it's like your car. If you decide to drive a car for 20 years, after 6 or 7 years, you have paid it back, and the residual 12 years, you drive the car purely on fuel costs and a little bit maintenance. And there will be a point in time when that goes well, and if you decide not to set money aside to buy a new car at some point, then you will have very low monthly costs because it's only your fuel and a little bit of maintenance. But there will be a point in time when your car simply doesn't do the job anymore and where suddenly your maintenance costs go up, and there will also be a point where it's simply not possible to fix the car anymore at reasonable costs. And that's the point in time where you now have to decide, do I buy a new car? If you buy the new car, now suddenly, in an instance, from 1 month to the other, your monthly car bill goes up significantly. That's exactly the situation we are in at the moment from the power system perspective. So it's as unfortunate as it is, the mathematical reality that the costs will go up. And it's due to the fact that the current cost of generation is based on a largely written off fleet, which doesn't face the capital cost anymore. The second aspect, that's the most important aspect, the second aspect is that the current generation fleet, the coal fleet, has access to very cheap coal mines, which for the next coal fleet will in most cases also not be the case anymore. Because there are just so many coal mines where it's very, very cheap to mine the coal, where you have the coal conveyor belt running out of the coal mine directly into the power station. That is the cheapest you can get. And now for new build power stations, that might not always be the case. We have some discard coal where it's also cheap, but if you go into larger scale, it will probably be more expensive. These are the two reasons. So it's not that the right-hand side is too expensive. It's that the left-hand side, the generation part, is actually not cost-effective. Then the question, what investment is needed to avoid load shedding? Well, that's a tricky question, I must say. We would need approximately, I don't have a number there, I just have to tell something back of the envelope. We would need approximately 5 gigawatts additional capacity if we could have 5 gigawatts additional capacity tomorrow, we would be out of load shedding. Now 5 gigawatts additional capacity, let's say if you build coal, 5 gigawatts will cost 150 billion. If you build gas, it will cost around about 50 to 60 billion, because gas is significantly cheaper on the CapEx side. It is more costly on the fuel side. But I think these are just thought experiments, and they don't really hold water, because we are not in a position to make the decision we want to have 5 gigawatts tomorrow. If we make that decision, we will have the 5 gigawatts in 5 years' time. So the only option that we have at the moment to get new capacity onto the grid very quickly is renewables in form of solar PV wind. That's the only option that we have that can come online within 1 or 2 years, given that the decision is made today. One option on the wind side, we have the problem with the grid connection, because wind generally, the wind projects follow the wind resource, and therefore the grid has to follow the wind. On the solar side, we are in the fortunate situation in South Africa that the sun shines across the country, no matter where you go. So on the solar side, you have more degrees of freedom in terms of where you install the solar PV installations, and you can follow a different paradigm, which is the solar PV thing follows the grid, and not the grid follows the solar PV projects. So, but what that means is we would need an enabling environment for grid connection of smaller and medium-sized solar installations, rooftop installations, residential, but also commercial. It can be megawatts, but on a rooftop at a customer site where the grid already is sitting there. There we won't have any problem with the grid connection side. But there the problem is more that we don't have a financial mechanism yet to compensate for such a small project. small project, let's say it's a half a megawatt project. If you have such a half megawatt project, it's completely not feasible to participate in the large procurement process because you have so many fixed costs and transaction costs that would completely destroy your business case. So for a half megawatt or 1 megawatt project, you need something like a standard offer. You cannot reasonably procure 10,000 small projects or 100,000 small projects through a competitive tender process like the large project. It has to be some form of standard offer, some form of a guaranteed tariff that is being paid. But that says, I mean, that is the only option really that can bring additional capacity to the grid very quickly and inexpensively, and it's a no regret move in the long term even, because you want to install more solar into the system anyway. That's what the IRP says. So and there you ask about private investments. Well, all the new power generators that are now coming online are actually privately funded. So what the government or what EFCOM does is gives the guarantee of the offtake and the guarantee of the tariff over the next 20 years. So that's where EFCOM and government has its skin in the game. But the funding of the actual CAPEX is done by the private sector. The O&M, question about the O&M costs. The O&M costs are factored in these costs on the left hand side. What is not in there are the costs of new builds. The financing cost of the new power generators are not in there in the electricity operating cost. But other than that, it's an all in cost number. And how to the O&M cost was also related to the renewable energies. Let's go back to this here. Yes, here we go. So on this slide, you see a breakdown. You not only see the total cost of a power generator, the 80 cents, 60 cents, and so on. You also see the approximate estimated cost breakdown. In terms of, you have, generally speaking, you have three big cost buckets. It's in any power generator. It doesn't matter which one. It's just a matter of how is it structured. You have capital. That's what you spend upfront. You have your fixed operation and maintenance costs. These are the costs that you have to pay every year and you're locked in because the generator is there. And then you have your fuel cost, which is the pure variable component. If you don't run the generator, then you don't pay that. And now you see that the total costs around the 8 cents and 1 rand toward the new build option are more or less on the same level if you forget about the right hand side for a moment. But the cost structure is materially different. Let's look at gas, for example. The gas-fired power station, 1 rand per kilowatt hour, 80% of that is in the fuel, which means if you build a gas-fired power station and you then decide not to run it, it doesn't really hurt you that much because of this inherent cost structure. On the other hand, for PE and wind, that's in the nature of the installation, there is no fuel cost, which means you as an investor and also as the system, you are locked in. So you have to make sure that if you build something that is capital heavy, that you actually need that energy. Because otherwise, if you don't need the energy, then the costs go up significantly. And that's also the reason why on the left-hand side, the PE and the wind investor needs a certainty about the offtake and about the tariff, otherwise you don't make the investment. If you invest into a gas-fired power station, you always have the option of not running it. The logic from a power system perspective is very, very similar to your own logic that you probably have applied yourself already in thinking what you can do at your home in terms to power your home. It's the same decision around do you build a diesel genset, which is cheap in terms of capital, but it's costly to run, or do you build a PV battery system, which is purely capital and has no running costs? And in that consideration, if you do that yourself, you will find that you think about things like how long will I be in the house, how certain am I about my electricity offtake in that house, all these things you will think of. For the diesel generator, you will just buy it. It doesn't matter. You can take it with you, and even if you don't need it anymore, it's a small investment. For the power system as a whole, it's exactly the same considerations. No difference. The lifespan of the renewables, well, these costs, these tariffs, are based, the 80 cents and the 60 cents are based on 20-year economic lifespan because the power purchase agreement is for 20 years. the actual technical lifespan is longer than that. On the PV side, you get a guarantee for the modules of 25 years, and a PV plant can, there's no reason why a PV plant should fail. You can always, the only thing that you will have to replace are in the inverter, the power electronics. But the modules themselves, if they are not physically cracked or destroyed, they will still produce electricity. So difficult to say what the exact lifetime is of PV, because the world doesn't have the experience yet. But there are PV installations around that are 30 years old and they still produce electricity. On the wind side, I would say after 20 years you will have to do some significant upgrades. But again, I mean, the main value for both, especially on the wind side, the main value is not so much in the capital that you spend, it's the value is in the site that you selected. And the site is still there in 20 years. And in 20 years, you still have the site, you upgrade your turbine, you probably use a more efficient turbine, a larger turbine, and then you keep on producing. But the site is still a good wind site. Then in terms of rural areas, off-grid, on the off-grid side, especially in a situation that we are in South Africa, where we have a very high electrification rate already, the first price is always to bring the main grid to the area. That's always the first price. What renewables and the cost competitiveness of renewables has done now, because you have the fuel source available wherever you go, so now you can think about building island grids, microgrids that are connecting areas, remote areas that are currently off-grid, but you should always do that with perspective in mind that in the mean to long run, the main grid should go there and connect them. For the simple reason that building the grid, as you've seen in this cost breakdown, building the grid, the transmission grid is a very, it's 10% of the total Eskom operating costs. It's always cheapest to connect to the grid, unless you are obviously 1,000 kilometers away, but you don't have that situation in South Africa. Always cheapest to bring the grid there. The problem is in most cases a timeline problem, because to build a transmission grid takes a lot of time, and that has to do with permitting and licenses that you need. If you build a 100-kilometer transmission line, there are 50 different landowners that you have to negotiate over to. It takes time. Yeah? But the renewables help on off-grid side is an immediate cure. Yes, you can think about it, but always with perspective in mind, the main grid should come there. In terms of profit from year one, again, if you look at this year, I assume if you ask profit from year one, you ask from a power system perspective. As we've shown, let me see, in this slide here, so the first renewables that came online last year, they made a profit for the economy. Yes. And they did that despite the fact that the first renewables that came online were the most costly ones that we will ever see in South Africa. And that is mainly because of this diesel fuel that was saved. In all fairness, were we not in the constrained situation that we are in at the moment, then these renewables would not have generated a net benefit, but they would have generated a net cost to the system. But we cannot really blame the renewables for the fact that the system is constrained. So this is a reality that last year they made a net profit for the economy, for South Africa Limited. So the short answer is yes, they make profit from year one. And if you think about that now, these total tariff payments to the renewables were 4.5 billion last year. This is with PE costing 330 and wind costing 130. If you now look at that cost item and apply the 60 and the 80 cents that we have for new projects, and this shrinks down to 1.5 billion, and immediately your financial benefits are much higher than they are at the moment. Then in terms of diesel, your question, sir, about whether this is very expensive what we are doing at the moment. On this slide, it's important to note that this is the pure. These are the costs of building and running and operating power generator in rand per kilowatt hour. So that does not mean that's what the power system pays per kilowatt hour. But if you look at the total bill that the power system pays, you would have to multiply these rand per kilowatt hour with the actual volume that is supplied by each individual power generator. And now if you look on the right hand side, on the diesel side, if you look at these actual numbers, these are the actual supply numbers for last year from 2014, you see that the diesel, which is the very tip of this mountain, is compared to all the rest a relatively small amount of energy that is provided by the diesel generators. It's if I remember the number correctly, it's 1.5% of what the coal fleet supplies is actually supplied by diesel generators. The problem is that the diesel generator is 10 times more expensive to run than coal, so that inflates this whole bill. But to your question, the question, is it expensive what we do? Well, let me put it this way, if we are not running the diesel turbines, it's more expensive because then we have more load shedding, and more load shedding costs more than 3 rand per kilowatt hour. That's the simplified answer to that. So there's the diesel turbines are actually meant to be the safety net for the system. They are meant to run a few hours per year. And if they run a few hours a year as per design, then it literally doesn't matter how much the fuel costs are. If you only run them 50 hours a year, it doesn't matter. Even if diesel costs not 3 rand per kilowatt hour, but 5 rand, 6 rand, it doesn't matter, because you only run them a few hours a year. Now in the situation that we are in at the moment, it does matter, because we are not running them only a few hours a year, we are running them a few hours every day. That's a problematic side of things. But if you build a new power system, based on these cost assumptions, you build a new power system, you will always build a blend of everything, and a small part of it will also be diesel or CCGTs, because they are the safety net. Then slide 17. So I think I answered that already. So the O&M is included on the left-hand side in these costs. Yes, and then the question about the difficult terrain and possibly to connect the customers. I think, yes, the renewable can play a role in getting off-grid customers electrified. Long-term perspective should always be to get them connected to the main grid.
Thank you very much. I know the colleagues from the select committee have other commitments. Chairperson, you want to, before you leave, maybe?
No, thanks. No, Chair, I'll remain with Ms. Zimande, Honorable Zimande. Will remain for the rest of the presentation. First of all, I think I appreciate the kind of information that we get from a reputable institution like CSIR. Chair, just for finding a solution on energy in the country, South Africa, I'm just interested, is there any, I know it could be uniquely, if the problem is not uniquely South Africa on energy, but are there any comparative countries normally in search for answers for sustainable solutions that you refer to?
Can I take one last one?
Honorable McLaughlin. Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I also appreciate the quality of the presentation, Professor Doctor. Thank you very much. I just wanted to know if you have any projection as to what percentage of our total supply could be provided by PVs and wind, realistically speaking, within the short term. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. I have a clarification question on page seven, on the issue of nuclear, because it seems as if it's definitely one of the solutions that is being used to generate energy. But then we know that there's such a terrible history on nuclear per se worldwide, you know, starting with Hiroshima and everything else. How do we take people on board so that people get an understanding that this is one of the best solutions, or is one of the solutions that need to be used as part of the generation of energy because of the history that it has? Thank you.
All right, let's allow.
Okay. In terms of comparable countries, you mean, if I may ask, with respect to solving an energy crisis or with respect to structuring and building an energy system in the long run? Are you looking at short run or a long run? If I may just clarify.
Long run,
okay. Comparable countries, you you would first look at the peers of South Africa, which would be Brazil, for example. But when it comes to renewables, you have to look at countries that have driven renewables in the past, with like the US, most European countries, Japan, now also China, and China is heavily investing, and China would also be kind of a peer to South Africa from an economic development perspective. And the way when we, so yes, we do these comparisons, and the way we look at it is that we try to normalize costs across different countries for the different natural resources that we have. It's the wind and on the PV side, these costs, the 8 cents and the 60 cents, are mainly driven by the availability of the free fuel, which is your wind and your sun. And so what we have done, we've put together a small database where we say, well, these are the costs that we see across the globe for solar and for wind. Now we normalize that for factors such as different solar radiation, and then we make it comparable and try to bring it onto one base that we can compare these costs with costs that we see in other parts of the world. Now, through that exercise, we actually gained a lot of comfort that the 80 cents that we see on the solar side are actually not the end of the game yet, because in more established markets when it comes to renewables, if you normalize for different solar resources, you see that as we speak today, South Africa should already be able to get PV at 60 cents per kilowatt hour. Because that's the tariffs that we see in the US and the tariffs that we see in Europe. If you normalize for the different solar radiation, we should get at 60 cents already without any further cost reductions in the future. So there's still room for the IPPs to become more competitive. Potentially we might need a different approach in procuring the assets, because of the high transaction costs that I mentioned in the beginning. In terms of percentage by PV wind, that speaks directly to the comparison with other countries, because we not only look at it from a cost perspective, but also from a structure of the energy system perspective. So there, in terms of percentage, we just not published yet, but we finished with an analysis on exactly that question, what percentage of PV and wind could be supplied in the near term. And we think a 40% number by 2030 is realistic to achieve. That would, however, require significant commitment in terms of procuring solar and PV, obviously. If we want to achieve 40% of wind and PV in the energy mix by 2030, we would have to procure between 1.5 and 2 gigawatts of both wind and PV every year until 2030. But it's economically feasible. It's economically feasible because these are the cheapest new options that we have at the moment, and the cost will come further down. And it's also technically feasible. And the added advantage would be that now, a little bit outside of the domain of what we are looking at, but from a macroeconomic perspective or a socioeconomic perspective, once you tell the market for the next 15 years, we will build 1.5 to 2 gigawatt of wind every year and PV every year. If the market has that certainty, you will find along the entire value chain local manufacturing setting up shop in South Africa if you have that secured kind of offtake. And that's a sizable market then. So that's around about 40% by 2030 is what can be aimed for. The IRP as it stands at the moment, the IRP 2010, has 14% renewables by 2030, so 1/4. And in terms of taking people on board with respect to nuclear, I'm afraid I'm not the qualified person to talk to that from a non-technical perspective, because my wife would say that I'm not the best person in non-technical issues. So I can talk technically about it, but how to convince people, difficult for me to say if it's not about hard numbers.
Well, honourable members, I think we've got that input. Highly technical, of course, but I think you understood it. I only decided to summarize. I'm assuming we all understood it. Thank you very much, Mr. Tobias. Bishop Nims, you can sit if you want to, but we can release it if you have to catch. satellite. What we'll do, honorable members, you all have the presentation to send to you. That's good. The next input will be from Mr. Trolley from the University of Cape Town, who will be the next presenter. I'm sure you also have that presentation with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Thank you, honourable members, for inviting me to share my thoughts on this issue of the Special Appropriation Act. I believe that's what's on the main issue on the table at the moment. But just by manner of introduction, Dr. Tobias he used to be a mechanical engineer. And I used to be an electrical engineer, and he's been telling you about electrical systems, and it's something that both of us spend our days when we're having a nice time looking at all the details of those systems, the costs and the technical details. And I often stay because I've actually seldom seen such a brilliant presentation of such complicated matters of explaining how a power system works in terms of your car and your home and fixed costs and operation costs, etc. First, you wanted to say that. I also wanted to say I work at the Energy Research Center at the University of Cape Town, and what he was describing, we work with 16 hours a day, those of us that love it, and I subscribe to all of the facts that he put before you. I agree with those. I think he was so correct at the end when he said he can put hard facts in front of you. But I also subscribe to the opinions that he presented on power systems design, which is largely what he was speaking about. So I just asked him to stay so I could say that. Okay, I'm going to change the topic a bit. I understand that I was invited here to discuss the appropriation of 83 billion rands. This appropriation is going to be by means of a direct appropriation of 23 billion rands and the conversion of loan of 60 billion rands to equity. And I'm going to try, even though I told you I'm an electrical engineer, I only did that for 10 years, from 1980 to 1990. And I spent about the following 10 years, a lot of it in these buildings, working on energy policy, electricity policy, the legislation that is being passed by us, being the people represented by you in these houses. And so I'm going to be talking about two issues, the appropriation of this 83 billion rand and how it fits into the very complicated issues that Dr. Tobias, I'll call him by his first name, was explaining to you. So with that as an introduction, I'd like to start off with some facts. I believe I have about half an hour, sir. Thank you. So, firstly, it's a fact that it's the uncontested policy of our government, backed by legislation and regulation, that Eskom and local government, electricity supply industry, be able to set tariffs that cover their costs. What this means is that we've decided in South Africa that only Eskom and local government can supply electricity to customers. And in order to do that, we've made a lot of choices and decisions, and we've said that in granting them licenses to supply, we will also, as a country, decide on how much they can charge, and we will make sure that what they charge covers the costs of their operation. We do understand that there are complexities in such a regulated system, in that Eskom and local governments might just become very fast and dodge anything they like. So, secondly, we've chosen independent regulation with transparent data and processes to set these tariffs and establish the regulatory process and institutions that should lead to outcomes, making sure these costs are covered. I'm going to talk about this later, but we're in a situation essentially where the costs haven't been covered, which is why we have to take a 3 billion rand, which has been sourced out of the general revenue fund, in other words, taxes, and given to Eskom. So this is a large departure from our established policy, legislation, regulations. And when I say we set up a regulatory process and institutions to make sure that we get this right, I'm just going to jump ahead by one slide. The primary institution meant to make sure that these tariffs cover costs is the National Electricity Energy Regulator of South Africa, which employs 177 full-time staff, 55 of which are in the Electricity Regulator Department. And they're all professionals, accountants, economists, engineers, and they spend all of their time discussing the kinds of issues that Dr. Tobias was discussing with you today, recognizing that the issues are so complex that it requires the full-time attention of these people to consider the kinds of details that Dr. Tobias was trying to explain to you in 1 hour. And we've done this over time and with a lot of consideration of options available to us. We spend a lot of money on NERSA. And that's just the tip of an iceberg, because this process involves people at Eskom and the Department of Energy yearly looking in depth at what it will take for these to run these systems and how they will cost. I think you get the point that I'm getting to. So Eskom probably has more than 55 people working on this. The Department of Energy has a whole lot, Treasury, etc., etc. So we've set the system up, but over the past years, starting in about 2008-2009, it has been routine that Eskom make applications for tariff determinations, and the ultimate outcome of these processes is that the tariffs that are approved almost bear no relation to what Eskom applies for, and this is communicated in the press. There's a record of this. One of my colleagues in the university, Anton Erhardt, presents a slide and he talks about what Eskom applies for each year and what they get, and he calls his slide pick a number, any number. And so that's why I end my third point saying that this tariff process excuse my cough, I've got a cold, have become disorganized. So we've set up through our economic policy, through our regulatory policy, through our fundamental setup of institutions, governance institutions, a whole system. And it's become disorganized to the point where in January, Eskom faced a problem of, in fact, not being able to meet its financial obligations to the point that it could be called illiquid. That's why we're sitting here. It's an emergency situation. Eskom's asking for essentially 83 billion. If you look at total Eskom revenues per annum, last year they were 136 billion. So you've got to see 83 billion in the context of 136. They're not asking for a little pop up. You've got to see 83 billion, for example, in the context of the South African government's budget for primary health care. In the current budget, 77 billion. Because we get a bit hamstrung with all these billions floating around. 1 billion here, 10 billion here, 50 billion there, 83 billion today. That's on the table. That's what we're appropriating. 77 billion is the entire cost of our primary health care, and you know how important primary health care is in this country. That's all of our clinics. That's what we're spending on in this area. So that's the size of this appropriation. And the reason that this appropriation is being asked for is because the system that we established, that with 177 people at NERSA doing full-time, and many more at Eskom, isn't working. Okay, so my last point there is, and this is why I put facts here, I don't think anybody would disagree with any of these because it's hard evidence. This points, because it's also isn't sudden, the loan that we're being asked
to turn into equity was made in 2008. And I'll return to that in a moment. But it happened suddenly. So I talk about a systemic undermining of this government policy of transparent, independent regulation and the institutions involved. And the institutions have been involved in a democratic governance system where we know and see what's happening and where we have the kind of people employed by NERSA full-time involved in the kinds of discussions that Dr. Tobias was having with us today. You can't resolve these in a couple of meetings. You can't look into this kind of detail with the brilliance of this presentation. There's a lot more to it than this. But suddenly, we're being asked to make decisions this big in an emergency. So I just wanted to paint that picture. I think what we have to accept, because if it's not done, and I think this has been argued very well by Treasury and ESM and the DOE, that we don't make up this funding shortfall that ESCOM faces, ESCOM will essentially be bankrupt. And it won't be able to borrow the kind of money that's required, for example, to finish building Casilla, or even to cover operations, to buy diesel. So that's the situation. But it didn't suddenly happen, and this is what I've been pointing out on the last slide. And unfortunately, this process might undermine the foundation of independent regulation if it becomes normal. Because, and it seems to be becoming normal, that we have one system running, but ESCOM regularly has to come to Parliament and to Treasury, etc., asking for money. The first large guarantees were made in about 2002, 2003, from what I remember. There were guarantees of about 60 billion made. There was already a crisis in brewing. So this is my... We provide a non-transparent... I just want to... Okay, so that's one picture. Now, we know where the money is coming from. It's coming from taxes. Where's the money going to? What happens when tariffs don't cover costs? So, what we have is a whole big system and it's providing a product, electricity. But it's not charging for that product what it costs to produce it. It's a shortfall. So, if, for example, there's a year that is a World Cup, so it's quite difficult, or there's an election, but unpopular, to put the tariffs up, but they need to be put up to cover costs. And so we don't. We undermine our independent regulator, and we just put the tariffs up to some politically acceptable amount. So we don't cover costs. Who actually is beneficiary of that? Well, beneficiary is the electricity customers that are then buying this product at the low cost. Now, usually, it's put up there that we can't put these tariffs up because the poor can't afford electricity. That's what I read in the newspapers. But the poor are only responsible for between 10 and 15% of electricity usage. 70% of electricity is consumed by energy-intensive industry. Probably another 30% by the commercial sector and mid to high income households. And, sorry, my arithmetic's not that good there, but the point I'm making is that it's not the poor. And we have specific mechanisms, the free-based electricity. We have specific mechanisms, the declining block tariff. I don't want to get into the complexities, as Dr. Tobias was, to protect the poor from these tariffs. So when we decide we're going to charge our electricity customers far less than it costs to produce electricity, it's largely energy-intensive industry. They are the beneficiaries. So what we're doing is we're deciding to take money from taxes and use of money to subsidize the electricity purchases by energy intensive industry. I hope that is 100% clear from what I said. If not, I really welcome interrogation on this point. So this means that we have a large non-transparent policy subsidy to the energy intensive sector generally and the electricity sector particularly. And this leads to large unintended economic distortion. In other words, we're undermining ourselves. We spend years in committees like this. We spend years with the best minds, our economists, coming up with systems and policies. But then we allow these tariff decisions. We don't face up to the fact that this is what it costs to produce electricity, and we make popular tariff decisions. And we just nullify all of this. So that's what I'm accepting is happening. So what do we do? Well, I don't know how many of you play snooker. I don't know how many of you understand the term snookered. Snooker is a game where you knock little balls around the table. And the idea is to get your opponent into a position where they can't hit their ball because you've surrounded the black ball with all your balls. So they've got no move. They're stuck. They have to do what you have to do. So we're snookered. It's a horrible thing that we have to do, to take 83 billion rand of our taxpayers' money, more than half of Eskom revenues, and rescue one of our previously premier state-owned entities from bankruptcy. But we have to. So I agree once again with Dr. Tobias. We have to actually approve this rescue package. And I'm not an expert in treasury matters. I was sent the treasury presentation, combined Eskom treasury presentation, and I looked over all the figures, and it seems like not a bad scheme. But so we're going to have to do it. So, I mean, you guys are sitting here, it's a money bill. We know that money bills have to be passed by Parliament because it's no small matter to just hand over 83 billion. So whether it has to be 83, it probably does as well. I'm not an expert, as I said, but figures make sense. So we're going to have to do it. So we probably have to make a provision. But I think we should do this on condition, because if we don't do it on condition, then we're always going to be snookered. So we're going to be presented where we have the illusion of being given choice, but actually we've been given what's called Hobson's choice by a system that we've been moved into. None of this. I came here in 1994 after spending 4 years in a project dedicated to supporting a new government in policy, etc., etc., and I've been involved very much in the system. Well, I've only been watching since about 2001, 2002, when I withdrew from direct involvement. Largely with some level of disillusion of how the technicians, etc., are being ignored. But this situation has been a plane crash in slow motion. So, and this is just part of the crash, this 83 billion. But what I think we need to do is, we need to say, do we want to watch this plane crash continue? Or should we admit to it and say, what's caused it and how do we get out of it? Do we truly believe in our institutions of independent regulation? Or do we want to read in the papers that NERSA decisions are overturned or undermined? So it's our institution, NERSA. It's not somebody else's. It's not them. They're not trying to make us do stuff. We decided on that. Or do we want to say, yes, but enough. We will make this appropriation. So when I talk about we, I'm talking about us, the people, not the executive and administration. Should we make this conditional? Do we have a can money laws be conditional? I don't know, this has to be done very quickly, or do we at least make some kind of comment saying it's conditional on the policy and practice and institutional capacity of NERSA being immediately re-established to do what the law, our policy, require it to do? Or do we continue undermining it? And do you measure that we re-establish cost-effective tariffs, seeing now demonstrate very clearly what happens if you don't have cost-effective tariffs, if you save the problems for later? So I'm going to borrow from Dr. Tobias's analogy of a car. You get one person that buys a flashy new car and they pay it off and they don't make provision for when they're going to buy their new car. Over the period that this car degrades, so that by the time they have to pay it in for almost nothing, they don't have the money to buy a new car, and they have to then have a major hit on their household budget, and they can't afford school fees and primary education, primary health fees, etc., etc. In other words, do we behave like a really irresponsibly in our financial plan? Or do we re-establish this principle at NERSA and DOE, etc., in our legislation and make sure that this doesn't happen again? So that is what I'm obviously suggesting, is that we don't allow this. We've learnt now what why in 2009 and 2010 and 2011 and still what the cost is of not having cost-effective tariffs. Load shedding, a disorganized system, the undermining of the democratic institutions. And secondly, remember every time we didn't put tariffs up, effectively, we transferred to the main electricity users a subsidy. I'll put some questions on this, but do people see that in 2010, when we decided not to put the tariff up, that what we said is the money that we're going to have to now appropriate, we're giving to the people that are getting electricity on the cheap? In many cases, energy-intensive industries that repatriated, those were the good years. That money is being made, those profits are being made, and they are already being fed, or they invested in something else. But we're going to pay for that now. So do we say that's fine? Or do we say, sure, we'll put up the, we'll make this appropriation, but we will put a premium on these tariffs, because why should the people that aren't getting the primary healthcare system forfeit that so that these large customers can receive the money destined for them to run their businesses? So maybe we should say if the kinds of people that have led to this system being disorganized, that have benefited hugely from this below cost electricity, get the signal from us that we're not open, we're not as a country in the business of passing over taxpayers' money to subsidize these kinds of things, and that we charge them with cost to produce. And we put this appropriation, we recognize that this is part of the cost of delivering electricity to those customers, and we charge them for it. So that is the second or third small bit point there. We say, we establish what the effective subsidy to these energy-intensive industries is in these appropriations, and we recover this amount in a tariff premium. I just want to make the last point there, that we always keep our eye on the primary goal of this government, which is to, at this stage, alleviate poverty, and that we make sure that if we increase these tariffs, that we use the existing mechanisms, which are good enough, if they're not, have additional mechanisms to protect the poor and provide them relief from these tariffs. And what I'm arguing about is what to do here is, if we don't do this, if we just appropriate and everything is fine, then we will essentially be allowing a very problematic governance regime to become further entrenched, becoming very entrenched, with far more severe problems down the line than we've got at the moment. So that is my proposal. I don't know if it's in the power of this committee to make notes on appropriation, but I just want to point you to the last time that such an appropriation was made and the conditions that worked on the appropriation, because I believe conditions can be put. So I'm sorry for the terrible text, but by the time laws, after they've been argued so hard through all of our processes, are finally printed, they're often impossible to read. But what the text there is the text of the last Low Appropriation Act, which says that Eskom will be loaned. A loan will be made for $30 billion. This is in 2008. And it says that the loan agreement must provide for, this is in one of our laws, payment terms that provide for the repayment of the loan over a 30-year period at market-related interest charges. Anyway, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just an engineer. But I noted with some concern when I had a look at the presentation made on the 10th of June by Treasury and Eskom that said that this conversion will have no direct cash flow impact either for Eskom and government. The funds were already appropriated between 2008, you saw, according to the previous act I showed you the text of, and Eskom is currently not paying interest on the loan, nor was anticipated to do so. Anyway, my little engineer brain, I can't get into the complicated finances, you know, accountants. But the way I understand a loan is, the difference between a loan and a gift is that loans get repaid. But now we're being told that suddenly $30 billion is not going to be repaid, and the National Treasury is telling us this will have no direct cash flow impact. Now, maybe it was only going to be paid in 30 years, and maybe I'll probably be dead by then. But surely there would have been a bit of cash flow when the loan was repaid in 30 years, even though it's a long time. Further, that no interest is being paid. Surely there's cash flow involved in this interest. So my worry here is we seem to be making money out of none. We're creating money here. No cash flow impact and we get an extra $3 billion. So I'm going to leave this with you to puzzle over, because all I can say is I've got a question mark over there for how this non-repayment of a loan has got no cash flow impact. But it boils back down to the questions that we're asking here. $3 billion is not a small amount, neither is 23. It came from taxes already paid, and it's going somewhere. And I believe our job, ours, because but it's really Parliament's job as a whole, because I believe part of the majority in Parliament requires to pass a money bill that this Honourable Committee will be advising Parliament, I suppose. If no big issues come up here, then Parliament will. And there's also this emergency snooker problem. But I just wanted to, and you can ask me questions obviously now, but my two questions that remain are we entrenching a system that is slowly creeping up and creeping in, which is undermining very, very carefully thought through and established institutions such as NERSA, such as independent regulations, such as democratic governance, and being presented with Hobson's choice at the last moment, and in the way that we participate in this, will we be entrenching this regime, or will we be recognizing how we've got here and making sure that we don't actually get into a worse position by entrenching this regime? Because it's my belief now, after facts and accepting and whatever, but having privilege of being able to watch this happen over the past 25 years, because that's been my job, I've got the very uneasy feeling that the system's being entrenched. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Sorry, from the University of Cape Town. Any comments, honorable members? Honorable Fink, honorable Mahatola, honorable Mahayu will be the third. Honorable Karmala, the fourth. Okay. Out of order.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thanks for the slow presentation, but I think the reason you wanted to make a point, Mr. Tolo, I'm agreeing with most of what you say, and I'll just indicate where I disagree with it. The first issue about how we got to where we are, and it was mentioned that the revenue is not covering the cost. There are probably more reasons than just the revenue not covering the costs. I'll deal with that just a little later with regards to the revenue versus the cost. But there are other issues that are mentioned in the analysis that has been done is your low tariffs, your low cost, your inability to meet the demand. And obviously that is where things like load shedding comes and revenue loss. So, and then your high maintenance costs. So, in my view, over and above the costs that the tariffs that you're receiving, perhaps the maintenance costs and the costs of your inputs are not being managed by the management of Eskom. I believe that is probably what is happening because surely some of the inputs are being sourced from your smaller enterprises, and worth is that the smaller enterprises get the supply from the bigger enterprises, and by doing just about nothing, just adding a markup, that adds to your cost, but be it as it may. Another issue is, you've mentioned that this has been coming along since 2004. Now what we're doing now, and I agree with the point you're making about being stupid, which you've been coming by saying we've been stupid, but if that has started a while ago, why put a sudden increase or massive increase now, because currently Eskom is asking for about a 24 or 25.8% increase in tariffs. So surely gradual increase would be much better than asking for increase of such a large amount. Now, I just want to get back to the issue about the costs, meeting the cost. Now, this figure that has been given to us by Eskom, the revenue is 171 billion, prime costs, and that's the cost of business, prime costs are 98 billion. So that leaves you with a gross profit of 73 billion rand. Then we have received information about other costs of 46 billion. Whatever the other costs are, it's not an issue, but then it still leaves you with a net profit before interest, loans, and then that included capital expenditure of 27 billion. So the cost, in my view, the amount that's left after your bus is 27 billion. And then obviously your interest and your loans and that sort of thing. So that's where that's why I come to the deduction that the problem is not so much the tariffs, it's more the fact that the costs are not being managed properly. That is where we have to look. And that's why you mentioned Nestle's involvement. And probably we need to get the number of employees that Eskom points currently versus the number of employees that they had, call it 10 years ago. Maybe one needs to look at that. The conditions that must be attached to the loan, I agree 100% with you. I just want to talk a little bit, if you'll allow me, Honorable Chairperson, about the appropriation versus and the conversion. Now, the appropriation, the actual appropriation currently, and I know we might be saying the same thing, but just in a different way. The amount that has been asked by Eskom now is 23 billion. That's wrong. The 60 billion is the amount that was loaned to them like years ago. You see, I don't believe that we can't help or isn't cannot be helped at this point in time because then the people are going to darkness 100%. But surely, whether the amount that has been asked by Eskom is going to be adequate, that's questionable in the first place, because remember we got into the situation because of maintenance. My concern is that looking at the cash flow, Eskom is about 55 billion at the moment, and they're asking government for 23 billion. Eskom claims that there are other sources of revenue, other sources of revenue that they will be able to generate, and the shortfall is going to be the 23 billion rand. So that's just one issue that one needs to put in a parking lot, is whether the 23 billion rand is going to be the only amount that Eskom is going to be asked for. The other concern I have with that 23 billion rand is that while the 60 billion was given as a loan, the 23 billion rand is now given as equity. So equity means that dividends have to be paid. And in a presentation that was given to this committee is that Eskom has not paid any dividends in the past, and they have no intention of paying any dividends in the future. So again, your conditional granting of that funding is important. With regards to the bill, in the bill it states that the amount is going to be paid in three tranches of 10 billion in June, 10 billion by the end of the year, and 3 billion in 2016. Hence the urgency of this bill being brought to Parliament by Wednesday. Now, what the bill states is that subject to payment into the National Revenue Fund from the sale of non-strategic assets. Now therein lies another issue, because if the 2010 billion is going to be paid now, have those non-strategic assets been sold already? What process was followed? To whom? And at what value? Because that is information that has not been made available up until now. So those are issues that one needs to look at. The other issue, let me just talk, Honourable Chairperson, I'm nearly done. The issue of the conversion of the loan to equity. Now, and you've touched on it with regards to low interest, even though the loan, well, I haven't seen the loan agreement, but I've seen the bill, but the bill states that interest must be payable, market-related value. But now, a loan that is granted in 2008 is being converted to equity in 2015 at the same value that the loan was granted 8 years ago. Surely that can't be right. Surely that can't be right. So those are the concerns that I have with regards to this situation that we are swimming into, using your words, if you allow me to, and that now must be, Eskom must now be saved. Thank you.
Okay, let's take Honourable Mendlole. I'll just take all four of them and then you can just go to the end.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Trump. Just to correct you, first is the amount that's covered in the previous Appropriation Act, 60 billion, not 30. So it's double the problem you could envisage. I agree with you that, and something I've been trying to establish is whether or not an agreement was in fact entered into between the minister and Eskom in case of this loan, because what Treasury tells us is that the real deal was that the first 10 years would be interest-free, and thereafter interest would be payable if certain ratios within the balance sheet achieved certain results, which they haven't yet achieved. So it looks like interest would only have been payable after 12 years. Well, now after 6 and 7 years, we are converting loan into equity with the problems that my colleagues just described. So it is a problem. But whichever way we cut it, we have a problem. What's happened in the past has happened. We now have to fix the problem, as you rightly say. So we snook it. We don't have a choice here. I just wanted to ask you whether you would give any consideration to what my colleague said. Should the 23 billion that's now being appropriated, is can be by way of equity, or should it also be by way of a loan with conditions? And whether you would consider any other way that Eskom may be funded, because the bottom line is Eskom needs funds. Without funds, it's going to plow in, and with terrible consequences to our economy. We have to bail these them out. Whatever the problems have been up to now, we have to resolve those obviously to prevent a repeat. But we can't turn a block back. What's done is done. But that basically is what I want to ask you. Have you given consideration to that aspect of it? And if so, what would be your ideas? Thank you, Jay.
Thanks, sir. I'm covered on the issue of the loan amount of 23 billion, and also, Prof, yourself welcome the earlier presentation that gives some hope and comfort that in the short term and the long term interventions with regard to energy mix provide some hope. And I do agree that. And the question that you're making, that the current fiscal and environment is constrained, and that appropriation committee should put its authority at what is granted, or that what we are discussing now, that loan be granted to the SCOP, should exactly attain the desired outcomes. I think that's what we really agree with the appropriation committee, that we have to assert our authority that what is granted to ESCOM exactly attains the desired outcomes. Now the issue that you raised, Prof, you said complex the complex situation that we are in. I think it's unavoidable that we have to deal with the situation that is obtaining. And in dealing with the situation that is obtaining, one point I think is critical that we'll have to deal with in a short and longer term is to deal with the state-owned enterprises such that there is no degeneration with regard to governance capacity to respond to these issues. At that point, I agree. But I don't understand when you say there's a systemic undermining of policy of government, systemic, implying that there's a chronic problem that we find ourselves in. I do not understand the issue of systemic, because it's consistent, coordinated effort to collapse the system, which I do not have the same view, because the ability to diagnose and respond to the problem is as important as coming out of a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I seek clarity first on the probably the same issue that Honorable Maha is referring to. I seem to understand that Mr. Tolip is saying our policy framework with regard to this matter is not problematic necessarily. The problem is at the level of governance and implementation of the policy. If we fix that in the first instance, we might start getting somewhere. I just want to try and understand that. The second area, Chair, is the issue that Mr. Trolley raises about how we seem to have undercharged to the extent that we have not been covering the cost of electricity so that ESCOM becomes financially sustainable. And what he says, if I understand him well, seems to be in agreement with what the acting CEO said last Friday when we met them there. Post-1994, we inherited this system of undercharged tariffs. Probably after that point, public revenue could afford these kinds of subsidies. Post-1994, because of the developments that have taken place up to now, and of course linked to the undermining of policy, public revenue can no longer afford these heavy subsidies, these big subsidies, largely to the energy intensive industries. And therefore we must now go back to saying, if we are asking NERSA for a new tariff, it must be a new tariff that takes into account the current and future costs of electricity provision. The last issue, Chairperson, which I want to clarify on, and we seem to understand that the issue of the independence of the entities, state entities, is important. But perhaps we need to balance that with ensuring good governance, efficiency, and accountability. Thank you, Chairperson.
Anyone else? Madam Court.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. May I thank Mr. Colley for his input. I would like to start with some of the facts which he put forth, which are quite true, that Eskom definitely needs to be funded, otherwise they will not be able to get any borrowing power, let alone to finish up areas, you know, around Kufuge and all that. And on a lighter note, I really wish if you had brought that slide from that colleague of yours whom you said it's a slide that said pick a number. You know, that's an important number, because I think that's a very, very informative type of an input which one would have liked to have had. It is important, Chairperson, to note what Mr. Tolik has stated, and that is on matters where ESCOM, the previous time when they were given 60 billion, it was a loan. But now with the 23, which is going to be staggered over a few months, there's a new term that is being used. But the point is, the money that has been used needs to be accounted for. I'm not going to repeat what one of my members stated, but the issue here is that we need to come out, or they need to come out, with what is termed the value for money, where if we follow up on the monies, we can straight away say they have actually done a good job on the issue. On the matter where Mr. Tolib said it like a, you know, a train crash, I think said a train crash going on slow motion, it actually means that we would be giving out the money, but acknowledging from previous experiences, maybe even from the 60 billion, that if we don't put in mechanisms to check if the money is used properly, if the people that are using the money are actually equipped to do that, as well as look at other areas, it is actually going to be a train that's going to crash in slow motion. So I definitely do agree with you. We need to put checks and balances on there. And lastly, on the very last issue that you spoke about, I think it's where you had a question mark, is the last part. Yes, of course, we as a committee, we can make recommendations to Parliament through our reports and actually state that, you know, ESCOM, irrespective of the change of words from a loan to whatever, because if it's a loan, it's like you've borrowed money. And if you've borrowed money, definitely you need to pay interest on that. That is the bottom line. Even if you go and borrow money from a bank, or you come and borrow money from me, and then you say you'll pay me off in 6 months, I've got a right to say, listen, this is the interest. I think we will definitely be looking at that quite clearly, at the conditions that are set forth. That is what the bill is all about, so that we can ensure that the taxpayers, the people that are actually forking out money, which is being used here, get an explanation
that will satisfy them, because it's important for the taxpayer to be the king or the queen, because that's exactly who they are, the king and queens of the show. So if we don't take them on board by informing them exactly what type of conditions will be put forth in order to ensure that their rents and cents are accounted for, then it means that something is not correct. So we will be looking into that. But I was quite interested where you said in your second sentence here, Eskom is currently not paying interest. We're aware of that. They didn't pay even the last time. But this time, we need to put in quite stringent regulations in order to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll give you 10 minutes to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for those really excellent questions. 10 minutes won't do justice to them. I'm going to try and do justice though by going through them. The first question was on, the way I understood it, was on Eskom's costs. Eskom had come to the committee and said, these were our costs, and there's a question around those costs. My answer is, there are two answers. One, if you have the NERSA process and the multi-year price determination, there's a 200-page document describing those costs. We're not going to get down to that. In this institution is not designed to run looking after Eskom's costs. But I agree with you. Those costs need interrogation, looking for, etc., etc. But as you can hear, I want to jump to the point here because of that we've got a framework. I believe it can work. It's a matter of governance and implementation. But we can have the worst of two situations if we have that framework and we're trying to implement another one. You know, you're changing a horse. What's that TV hero that's got two trucks and they go wider and wider and wider, and then he ends up in a mud hole on his bum? But you can't ride two horses. You can't. So we must make the system we've got work, or we must choose another system. But the system that we have got is not working. So we must make it work, or we must choose another one. And I think that's at the heart of a lot of this. But governance and implementation are huge challenges for us. We know that. They're not simple. So maybe we don't pitch the system just because the first time of making it work we have problems. But we go back and we say, can the system work? Ask that question. This independent regulation. The governance that's talked about inside state-owned entities. This is all new. The Eskom Act, the way SOEs. And we need to fix that. So those two questions. I'll try and move through some other details. This issue, Eskom said they need 55 billion, they're only asking for 23. What happens with the conversion, sorry, I made a mistake, because that's 30 billion, 60 billion, the loan being converted to equity. What happens if you've got a loan and you convert it to equity? Beforehand, you had to make a provision to pay that money back and interest. All of a sudden, if it's equity, it's yours. And what you could do is you can borrow more money because you've been given. That's how Eskom's going to get the other money. That's the logic behind this appropriation and the conversion of the loan to equity. So by converting the loan to equity, you're putting Eskom in a position to go to the debt markets and borrow against that. But we've also foregone our right to the repayment of the loan, which is significant, but I've made that point. So tell me, maybe I'll go through quickly and you can tell me if I've missed 10 points. This real deal versus the deal. I just want to go to this point. That's the law. That's the real deal. I'm very worried if they're real deals that we pass a law, but actually we're doing something else. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that there's a systemic, that there's a third force undermining this or whatever. But what I'm saying is the kinds of interests that we're dealing with are difficult to manage. They're difficult to regulate. They're powerful. It's hundreds of billions of rands. Obviously, they hire the best players, the best accountants you can get in the world to make sure that they look after their interests. That's their job, to make profits, to run businesses. We've got to have equal people on our side to manage our interests, which we hold the interests of the people of South Africa in our hands. So it's not that.
that I'm saying there's a nefarious undermining of the system. I'm saying it's a hell of a difficult to manage these people because they're big, they're tough, it's hundreds of billions. But we've chosen this independent regulatory system, looking around the world at all the systems and similar problems being faced by other countries, and they've chosen it, we've chosen it, so we must make it work or choose another system. And if that answers that. Equity, future versus the past. I completely agree, the past is the past, but what you can at least do from the past is take lessons. If you can't say, oh, the past is the past, we must just go ahead. What have we learned from this process? I think we have to sit down and say, what happened over this period? How come, why do we need maintenance on these plants? I'm going to quickly spend 3 minutes saying that in cabinet in 2001 told Eskom it couldn't build power plants, despite the fact that everybody knew if we didn't start building in 2001, we'd run out of power. It took until 2004 to cabinet to reverse that decision and say to Eskom, please build as quick as possible. Eskom then started building by 2007. That's when Madrid started being built. So when Eskom used to be building these power stations, the last big six power stations, and they knew how to do it, and they had a whole division of doing it, and they were world leaders in it. Average time taken to build a large coal-fired power station was 9 years. So when Medupi comes on stream in 2016, it will be 9 years from 2007 when they started building it. That's how long it takes to build a 5 gigawatt power station. That's why when we run out of power in 2007, the pressure started mounting on Eskom operational staff to run their power stations when they should have been doing maintenance. They've been working 24 hours a day since 2005, and now they're told they're not doing maintenance, but they're told you can't do maintenance because if you do maintenance, you have to take power stations off the grid, and there's load shedding. We ran out of power in 2007. That is a historic fact. If you look at stats South Africa data, I can send you the slide, and I'm going to ask my colleague if I can send you, pick a number in another slide. Stats South Africa collects total electricity consumption in South Africa. In 2007, total electricity consumption in the country peaked after rising for a century with a few clips, and it's been flat since then. Last year, we used less electricity in South Africa than in 2007. That's not because people wanted less. It's because in 2007, that's when we reached the peak of what we could supply. We haven't put anything more in grid since then. So this is what I talk about, the slow motion train capture. When we decided not to allow them to build power stations in 2001, even if there were environmental problems with the station they were choosing or whatever, it was an inevitable consequence. And I think we need to go back and say, how did we get to this position? We're all in it. And how do we avoid it? We really need to take a very, very measured, proper, systemic assessment of how we got there. We're not going to have time for this appropriation bill. This could be part of the bill. Saying, sure, we're giving you the cash, but the condition is, we would like this kind of commission or whatever to establish how we got here, so that we're not sitting in 2025 saying, how did we get here, which is much worse than where we are now. Yep, state-owned entities, governance, it's a new system, it's a complex situation, this is what you're talking about. Framework, the undercharging. This is an important point, because I have seen it once again reported in the newspapers, but not a backup point. Pre-1994, in the general scheme of things in South Africa, there was a massive subsidy. Basically, the whole of government didn't make provision for most of the people in the country, so they saved a lot of money on healthcare, education, etc., etc. And so the whole economy was skewed, and it could come up with these low-cost schemes, because of that. But the essence of our system has never been the tariff must cover costs, because in the pre-94 system tariffs also covered costs. It has never been that Parliament would appropriate money to electricity supply. Never been part of the system. This is new. In other words, it's an aberration. It's always been the case that tariffs have been designed to cover costs. The electricity system has been run like that in this country. So I think it's important. I forgot who asked that. I've got the note. Value for money, absolutely. That's on the conditions. When they're going to have these conditions, well, being unhappy, this is me talking, and as a taxpayer, I'm saying, for every one of the 23 billion, I can see some of my rands in there. I've got a right to know that it's not just going through Eskom to subsidize some big user's electricity bill so they can make bigger profits. Well, if it is, that we've taken that decision as the economic policy of our government, that we're going to use taxpayers' money to subsidize large electricity payers' bills. That's, then you can vote on that, then it's a policy of the government. But I want to know about that, if that's where my money is going. Okay, a bit of pressure, 10 minutes and long questions, but I'm going to leave it at that. I hope I've covered all the...
Okay, I'm sure we've got your details. If honourable members want to follow up the issues, they will be able to get hold of you. Thank you very much, Mr. Tobias. Thank you very much. Honourable members, there's something to... eat and drink as we continue. I now want to welcome Professor Philip Lloyd from the Energy Institute of the Cape Peninsula University of Technology and Mr. Rob Jeffrey from Econometrics. I'm told that you have a joint presentation. Okay. Yeah. They will arrange for you to come and connect.
I'll just take all the whole time if you've got to.
You're welcome.
Thank you, and thank you also for hearing out a couple of random thoughts. We have the advantage of a little bit of experience, and B, we're mainly worried about our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So we haven't actually got any axes to grind. So I hope you'll hear us out. The basic message is we want to actually reinforce quite a lot of what Mr. Hilton has just been saying. First of all, if our economy is going to grow, it needs electricity. Electricity is an essential part of all industry and everything else. It is an absolutely necessary function. It's not sufficient. There are other things we require to grow, but it is, if the economy is going to grow, we've got to have electricity. And that means that Eskom has got to grow as well. I'll talk a bit further about that. One of the interesting things, just trying to analyse the situation we're presently in, is that many of the decisions that we've been taking about Eskom's operation in recent years have been those that have been politically driven rather than financially driven. There are both good reasons for those. But the problem is that because of the structure of Eskom, it's been very difficult to try and allocate those costs properly as a political cost rather than commercial costs. Again, if you heard, an awful lot of the financing of Eskom has been commercial. And what we see coming out of this is, particularly with the creation of an equity stake in Eskom, is that it creates opportunities to do some restructuring. The restructuring has long been talked about, but this is past the moment when the finance side of things needs to lean on Eskom and say, get the structure of your business in shape so we can actually see where the costs are going. So let's now just talk about why Eskom needs to grow. We know about the shortage of capacity. We know that it is disastrous to the economy. We've been able to measure that. Every missing kilowatt hour costs our economy today about 85 knots. Just think about that. If you don't have the power, it costs you a lot of money. It's one of the reasons why, for instance, Africa is so poor. It doesn't have electricity, and electricity has got a worth to the economy of the order of 85 rands. There is coming out of things like the National Development Programme, an idea that our energy intensity is falling. It is falling, that's quite true, but it's a very misleading sort of conclusion, because if you've got a constant amount of power coming out, and you've got a slightly growing GDP, then energy intensity will fall. It's an arithmetic fact. It can't help but do that. So it's a misleading thing to say the energy intensity of our economy has fallen. We need more energy, only because we've got a growing population. And just then, the growth of our population means that we need each and every year about 4 terawatt hours. And that's just meant to cope, which is equivalent to about 500 megawatts of baseload capacity. That's just in this case about growing population. Nothing else. No new economic growth. We need more power, and that's what we've got to try and find some way of financing our way to that. Now, this, I don't know if you guys think of this, this is a plot of why South Africa is an industrializing economy and what's it.
Thank you. This is a very important chart because we are still an industrializing country. And in fact, we're still on the left-hand side of the graph about 3 or 4 centimeters down. And one of the reasons our electricity intensity has been declining is obviously the words that Professor Lloyd has just mentioned, but it's also because we have grown our service sector, not our goods producing sectors. I've addressed the Reserve Bank on the subject, because without really looking at our goods producing sectors, which are mining, manufacturing, and also our agri-processing sectors, we cannot produce sufficient goods, and that affects our balance of payments. It also affects the structure of economic growth in terms of the employment. It leaves unskilled people out of work. And you cannot make the movement directly from the industrialization side to the other side without huge and catastrophic losses to the economy. The view is, right, we must develop our service sector side, and we don't need to develop our goods producing sector, and we also don't, we have plans that will not allow us to generate sufficient base load power for the manufacturing goods producing sectors. All those are going to cost a considerable amount of money.
I spoke earlier about the fact that there were political rather than commercial decisions, and these are some of the examples of the political rather than commercial. There was, you heard about earlier on in the previous talk, the delay in the construction of the new power station. That was a political decision that wasn't properly fully costed at the time. There was also the provision of free basic electricity. The research had shown from around the world that the provision of free basic electricity was a poor idea, and there are a number of reasons. I'll come back to that a little later. And then in the early 2000s, the then electricity regulator gave below inflation electricity price increases because he wanted to fight inflation. And that was one of the reasons why the electricity price stayed not only low, it was started off the lowest in the world, and it would even lower. And that meant that Eskom's finances were very severely affected in that period. There was the renewable energy program has been run by the Department of Energy rather than by Eskom and the Department of Public Enterprises. And I think we have to look at the success of that program when we start looking at the money that is now being sought by Eskom, because its competitors from renewable energy have just attracted 190 billion rands. That hasn't affected the business at all. That must surely tell us something about how Eskom should be doing business and how it presently is doing business. Then there's also the question of coal purchases from small black and coal mines. Came out in the responses to the Energy Minister's recent budget speech that some of the coal mines are getting as much as 460 rands a tonne at the pit head, and then there's another 200 rands a tonne actually delivery costs to the Eskom power stations, whereas the majors are getting less than 200 rands a tonne. So we understand why that is there, but it's a political decision that Eskom is buying very expensive coal from some of these small coal mines. We need to reflect that somewhere in the fact that it is a political decision we have to pay for. And then there's this question of the ballooning debt from the municipalities, that Eskom is actually missing money that it should have got. The cost of these various decisions, the delay in the new power station, as you know, has led to the present power crisis, but it has some other knock-on effects on the economy. One of the interesting ones is the fact that as in the last of the old power stations, Majuba was finished, and because the new power station didn't come online as expected, many major foreign firms left the country and took with them hundreds of engineers who have got the skills that we now recognize we would have had if only we'd done that thing at that time. We're now having to rebuild that pool of skills, and we're cutting up, he's learning all over again at Majuba and Kazile. The provision of free basic electricity had a number of foreseeable problems. One of them would give rise to a culture of non-payments, and also would be seen as very unfair to those who had no electricity. They would turn around and say, why are they getting something for free when we've got none whatsoever? And that was foreseen, and it has caused problems that were really unexpected. One of the below inflation increases have led, of course, to above inflation increases in the Eskom costs today. the saturation of the renewable energy program has meant some other expensive costs for the connecting those renewable programs to ESCOM. One of the large projects, about 100 megawatts, has not been connected for over a year because of the disconnect between the Department of Environment Affairs and, sorry, the Department of Energy and the Department of Public Enterprises. And one of the things that has come in is that the future costs of renewable energy have been fixed by the Department of Energy, so there's no possibility for any competition. The competition has taken place up front, and the future costs are going to be incurred whether we like it or not. And I mentioned earlier on that the coal from the small coal mines is costing far more than the coal from the large mines, and that is giving rise to an inflation in the costs of ESCOM, which hasn't been picked up in anything that I've seen so far. Now I turn back to my fellow presenter.
Thank you very much. This next slide actually shows the impact of certain policies. I would just like to reflect, we've done research going back to see how much the past decisions and shortages have cost in this economy since 2008. It amounts to something like 300 billion rand is the cost of it. And I also like to point out that actually it's well over a million jobs. And if you multiply that by the dependency rate, it's 4 million dependents that have been affected by this. One of the effects, though, let's look at the future, is the impact of renewables. Whether one likes, it has actually been very good in the meantime because we've had a shortage of baseload power. So there has been a certain benefits. However, the shortage of baseload power would have meant that we wouldn't need so much renewable. And the renewable cost alone, if you take the cumulative effect up to 2030, because it is variable, it requires full backup, would cost this economy something like 300 billion if it was on a major scale. And it would cost something like 1.5 million in employment. The fact that there are many policies which are affecting investment in this country, including, and I'm not going to list all of them, but I mean, obviously, there's certain structural problems, there's the electricity problems, there's the labor relations problems, and then the regulatory problems affecting mining and security of Kenya and other things, and general corruption is estimated to cost a further something like in fixed investment, it will slow the growth rate of this economy down from 4.1% to approximately 2.5%. And the effect of that is a further 10% reduction on a cumulative basis of 500 billion. So just taking those two policy increments that we are going for on an excessive basis, there is a place for renewables, but not for baseload power. And those costs were something like 800 billion and an effect of 4 million in employment over the period to 2030. And we haven't included yet if the carbon tax was introduced, and that's another matter, but it would be very substantial.
So I'd like now to discuss some of these structural problems. But the thing is that ESCOM is a very big business. It has a very high volume of sales, and its nominal cash flow has been sufficient to allow it to be very highly geared. But the problem is that cash flow has been interrupted by non-payments, and that is now feeding through to the whole question of the gearing and the financial structure of ESCOM. Certainly, one of the interesting things about ESCOM is that the tariff has been controlled by NERSA with no consideration of transmission costs. They've been hidden in the overall tariffs. So that the connection cost of renewables, for instance, and other independent power producers, are not readily identifiable and not readily costed in. The whole question of restructuring of ESCOM in order to try and make these things come to life was foreseen in the 1998 white paper. There have been several attempts to carry out some restructuring. There is the very stalled independent system and market operator bill that has made absolutely no progress in about 5 years. And the present proposals for restructuring finances of ESCOM should really call on this committee to get a commitment from ESCOM restructure their business in a more sensible way so that the costs of various decisions can be more readily visible and seen. And one of the things that, of course, is apparent is that if you're going to put some equity into ESCOM, then the possibility of being equity out of the private side of things comes very readily to light. And the success of the renewable energy program under the Department of Energy really has to be noted there. It has managed to attract, as I said earlier, 190 billion without any pain on the fiscal whatsoever. And that shows you some of the benefits of having a bit of privatization around the place. So in considering restructuring, we actually looked at the functions of ESCOM. It's got generation, where there's already competition between it and the renewables and various other income generators. We looked at one of their functions is transmission, and what it basically provides is a national highway to push electricity around the place. And that has no competition, and in fact, worldwide, there's very little competition in the transmission sector. And finally, come down to distribution, where ESCOM is actually responsible for about half the electricity distribution nationally, and the municipalities for the other half. And so there is already a level of competition at that stage. And this really suggests to us a structure where there's an electricity supply company generating and supplying electricity in open competition with other suppliers. There's an ITCOM, an electricity transmission commission, which is a national resource purchasing electricity from the various suppliers and distributing it in bulk to the distributors and to bulk users. And finally, there's something we call ITCO, an electricity distribution company, which buys electricity from ITCOM and it distributes to users in competition with other distributors. This, the ESCO and the ITCO would be expected to make profit in order to fund their operations, as they presently do. They would then contract to the state to undertake any politically desirable projects, such as a further rollout of electrification, for instance. Whereas ESCOM, the national resource, would look very much like the present ESCOM. It would be a cost-plus operation, and its capital expenditure would really be direct charge against the fiscus. It could make a bit of profit. But much as the national roads have been done, it could be seen as a toll highway, if you like. And that would be the sort of structure that we would see. NERSA would change the nature of NERSA. In the restructured world, it would regulate the prices for generated power, the cost of transmission, and the cost of distribution. And it would significantly improve, we think, the state oversight of the industry if NERSA were, the functions were extended and simplified in this way. Because currently now, as you've already heard, there are discussions as to how NERSA arrives at these the costs it does. It takes a 200-page document every year to try and sort out the costs of electricity in the country. And it doesn't do a very good job of that because, as we know, that for the user, there's something like 1,600 different tariffs across the country for getting electricity. And that seems completely ridiculous. We tried to do something about that for a long time and haven't succeeded. We think that the opportunities created by creating equity in ESCOM mean that you can release it, you can privatize some of these things without too much pain, and it will significantly improve the overall situation. So our recommendations are to divide ESCOM into a base power generation, a transmission, market and control operator, and a distribution company. And fund each according to their business requirements, and some of them will be self-funded, partially privatized generation and distribution. To extend the independent public users and try and foster equal competition there as far as possible, go for the best possible commercial business procedures, have some independent management and board appointees for the three separate entities, make certain that all tenders are awarded on a strictly arm's-length business basis, maximize the security supply of electricity generation, and ensure the lowest possible costs of that overall, with the prime objective of reducing the cost of doing business in South Africa. And I think we'd like to add anything. Finish off.
Yes, great. We've been involved in the econometrics in the electricity side for something like 5 years ago, for the past 5 years in deep sense. The operations of ESCOM are a national asset. They belong to the public and the private. They affect both. And I'm now looking at it as a national state of the generation, transmission, and distribution. They have to be managed properly and efficiently. What we interested here is what we can learn from the past, as was said previously, and what we should do in the future. And the important point that one's got to bear in mind, that you've got to say, what does South Africa need over the next, up to, say, 2030? We need a lot of electricity. people forget that we have to replace many of the power stations that are already getting old and are inefficient. So one is talking over that period of something like doubling the size of Eskom from 40,000 megawatts to approximately 80,000 megawatts. I'm talking not Eskom, generation power. And at the same time, one's got to recognize that that's going to cost over R1 billion. That's in current terms. And clearly that is far too big for one particular entity to control. And hence, it is imperative that one actually capitalizes these operations properly so that the shareholders bear the cost of efficiency and inefficiency, and one doesn't have a situation where actually those costs are just passed on to the customer. And because that will ruin business in South Africa to the extent of the figures that we have indicated here. The further point about replacing such power stations would be that one of the quickest ways of reducing the carbon footprint is just to use more efficient processes, which includes cleaner coal. We need really to look at utilizing having a short-term solution and a long-term solution. Short-term, you've got to go for certain matters which can provide power fairly immediately. But what is specific to what is being discussed here is that it is absolutely imperative to start capitalizing Eskom before it's fit, if that is what is decided, into its equal components, and it has to be capitalized correctly with proper funding in the equity portion, just as you would do in a business. And the costs that are passed on must be separated from political costs, which have to be held back on another side, and efficiency costs, which means the people will only be charged for efficient operations, as is correct, because if you don't do that, you will actually affect some of the prime objectives of, and one of the prime objectives is reduce the cost of doing business in South Africa, seek to employ more people, and one can also have reduce your other costs that are associated with unemployment, which might per se includes a lot of medical and other costs which do not feature but are featuring very much in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof. Lloyd and Mr. Jeffrey. Honorable members, your comments? Straightforward. I think one of the things we should say, Prof, that obviously some of the issues you raise are policy matters that we may not necessarily deal with them as we pass the bill next week, because they may require other processes in terms of the other portfolio committees that deal with issues of energy. But I think this is useful, because if looking to the future, say yes, we have a problem now, how do we sort it out going forward? Maybe there's a need for restructuring, etc. Those are some of the things that may need to be discussed even further going forward. But let me allow members to comment on this input. I know honorable members is now the whole week you have been discussing Eskom, the conversion of the loan, and you're tired of that. You've had enough. Prof is here. He said we must restructure Eskom. What do you say? Honorable Mohan.
Yeah, I think that I agree with the view that you're expressing some of the issues more really for policy. But I just wanted to ask you, Prof, specifically that have you undertaken a research with regard to you raised issue of fragmentation, I think, how the relationship between different energy providers. Have you done some extensive work related to that? also there's an issue that you made. I don't know, but it's more of a policy issue really, that you say some of the politically taken decision as opposed to commercially based decision. I mean, there are pros and cons there. I think government, I do agree, I think all of us know that government did at some point make a public acceptance that the decision that he took at some point were incorrect about not to build new power electricity generating stations. Now, I think that is a historical fact they did own up. But there are some other issues which you raise, borders on policy. Eskom exclusively doesn't source from emerging mining companies on coal, but it's part of addressing the glaring problem, I think, in the country of the policy, which is correct, because I don't think you argue that to de-racialize the economic ownership patterns in the country is incorrect. So some of the issues you like striving through, maybe because of time constraints, because it could have been interesting to look into the developmental path we're taking as an SSLV, the unintended consequences, but the correctness of policies that has to be adhered to in the country. But also I agree that the platform now may not be to extensively deal with the issues that you're providing.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to the presenters. I have started the way my colleague did, especially on those coal purchases from the small black-owned coal mines. I would like to just inquire from the two gentlemen, Professor and your colleague, how would you see us addressing this matter? Because here it's stated as an issue that is problematic. Not necessarily going into detail, but just to get the feeling, because here it's a matter of redressing the imbalances of the past. But then how would we feel, or how do you think we can actually address this matter? Because as part of redressing the imbalances, we definitely need to go that route. I think there's also the matter where it says that some of the stations or major stations were not finished when it came to the construction, because most of the engineers had to leave because they were coming from other countries, if I should put it like that. Again, I would like to ask a question. How many engineers do we have in our institutions, engineers that are in training? Because noting that is a problem, it means that we need to prepare ourselves so that in future we don't see the same problem. It's because, you know, with this type of qualifications that you've been talking about and the high class type of expertise that we need, from the leaving of those engineers, we need to have prepared ourselves as a country. And we haven't seen much even newspapers over the large number of students, especially even coming from the disadvantaged communities, going into this type of field. What is being done? Because as part of the redressing and the restructuring, we need to look into that. I haven't seen it even in papers. At times I do know of certain institutions where you find that if you start off with 200 students in a year and we break them down into races, those that are black like me might be more in your group, it could be 100 plus, but by the time they complete, it would be 5. And they deliberate, ensuring that they are actually pushed out of the way so that it leaves particular races or particular people into those professions, if I should put it like that. How are you actually addressing that? I think both of you are highly qualified and you are quite matured in your education so that you can educate me on what we're doing about it. Lastly, Chairperson, I've also noted that on as part of the restructuring, especially the commitments of ESCOM, I've noted here, I think this is page 13, where Prof and your colleague have actually gone into these companies. I think it's called ESCO and the ESCO. Are these existing companies? Because if they are existing companies, I think one would like even for the committee and researchers later to get more information, because, you know, out of all the companies that are prepared to do what these two companies would be doing, we have actually zoomed in on the two. So it's quite important that one gets a feeling of who they are, what they do, you know, not necessarily today as well, some of the information there, BEE status and everything else, because we need just that as part of our restructuring. Thank you.
Honorable Fix.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. There's an interesting slide, number 8, with those interesting figures there. Could I just get a response from, I think it was Mr. Jeffrey that presented that. How are those figures arrived at? Where did those figures come from? Please, doesn't slide. That the impact of policies. Those interesting figures, yeah.
Clearly, I can't outline all the methodology. We have gone into the costing. There's a full report available on this. And we also presented, by the way, to the Carbon Tax Committee, where we outlined all the methodology as well. The initial one was costing up renewable resources set against coal, set against nuclear, and so on, the relative cost of those. And once one averages that out, according to what future policy will be, and you accumulate it over the period to 2030, and those were the figures that came out on renewables. We had some other figures which were on carbon tax, which were over and above this. But sticking to the next point was the impact on fixed investment. There's a certain amount of fixed investment which is affected by every single price increase in electricity. And just in general terms, if you have a look at what is going on at the present time, if it were to continue with all the various policy components, there was a calculation that we did with our econometrician, Dr. Johannes Jordan, and he came out with a figure that it affects domestic and foreign investment. You know, both of them are components in the investment equation. And the impact of that is very, very dramatic on the economy. So that's where those figures arrived at, and where the employment GDP figures and employment figures came from. To go into it in depth is not possible at this meeting, but there are those figures available.
You can respond off, and then I'll take care. Or you are still... Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, before that...
I'm going to give us an apology. No, just can that information be sent to us, please.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Prof,
we can send... what you're essentially asking are two reports which we actually submitted to the Carbon Tax Committee.
Right. Okay,
Paul. Yes, if I could, some of the... have we undertaken any research into the fragmentation of energy providers? I think probably the closest study we've undertaken is a study of what is happening in Germany, where you may be aware of the fact they've got a very big energy experiment on the way, and many electricity providers, different providers going in there, and it is causing some very interesting challenges to the German electricity supply altogether. For instance, some of the gas-fired power stations are finding it uneconomic, the present prices of gas in Europe, to compete against the renewables. But they need those gas-fired power stations to keep the grid stable. And there are technical problems rather than commercial problems around this fragmentation that is taking place there. On some of the political decisions, and in particular, were two questions regarding acquiring coal from BEE coal suppliers. I quite agree, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, except the fact that the costs have not been properly allocated, it seems to me, at any rate, within the ESCOM side of things. They can come along and say, one of the reasons why our coal is costing more is because we have to pay more for that particular political decision. And that really should be reflected in their books, to that extent, the fact that the coal is being separately priced, and therefore ultimately we're paying for that. And that was a political decision. I think it's a sensible political decision. I can't argue with it. But the simple fact of the matter is that it's not reflected in the present costing structure. All we hear about from ESCOM is all the cost of coal is going up, and therefore we've got to increase the prices. The reason is
not necessarily the cost of the coal, but the cost of the fact that there's differential pricing of the coal. The question of the loss of engineers, yes, indeed. But the real thing that I was trying to, it was the loss of skills that went with the decision to delay the construction. And there was a very significant loss. Some major corporations retired off to Germany and things like that, taking with them, as I say, hundreds of possibly skilled engineers. Engineers are a movable feast. They tend to go around the world on contracts if you want them. Generating your own is obviously desirable. The figures from the Engineering Council of South Africa suggest that we've got around about 15,000 engineers of those sorts of courses in South Africa. We've got something like 4,000 in training right now. I think we're doing quite well. There is, of course, a problem that many of those who enter engineering with the best in the world have come through schooling systems that leave a lot to desire. We're particularly bad in mathematics, as we know, and many of those people who come poorly prepared in mathematics have come from disadvantaged communities, which do suffer an additional drop-off because they have been poorly prepared. Many of the universities already have reinforcements for people like that arriving at the universities. Many added an extra year onto their own education to try and make good the lack of education at the school level. But I think it's a bit much of this committee not worrying too much about what's happening in schools. That's really taking your remit a bit far out of the way. But I stand open to correction. That was my personal feeling. As regards the ESCO and INCO, no, they're not business companies. But they could very easily be companies because what has happened around the world. That generation and distribution have become commercial operations in their own right. But as I said earlier, what has long been spoken about as the independent system and market operator, the transmission operator, that has not been, nowhere in the world has that become a company. So, do they exist at the moment? No, but they could very easily exist. And the creation of an equity investment in ESCOM makes that all the easier for that to happen, and it makes a lot of logical sense.
If I may just comment just generally. First of all, I would genuinely like to thank the lady on the other side who described us as well matured. She didn't say we were fermenting, so I was quite pleased about that. But anyway, I think, please note, when we've been talking, we have not said privatize. It's a public-private partnership. It is not a privatization of ESCOM as a total, as some people have said. The second point I would like to make is that higher growth is the best way of creating transformation. And most importantly, by the way, we've done a study to look at what is on the effect of the on Gini coefficient. And higher growth makes a significant difference to the Gini coefficient as well. And it creates transformation opportunities. And then finally, one's got to look in all these things at cumulative rollout. In other words, successive rollout. As Professor said just a moment ago, we made the mistake of leaving a lot of our skills left to move on elsewhere in wherever it is. Even now, we have, so I've understood from very good sources, problems with Madupi and Kusili are mounting because there's no real succession of any further power stations which will employ those people. So it is absolutely vital in whatever area it is to try to build a rollout program over regularly coming out over a number of years. I'm not concerned whether it's built by ESCOM or whether it's built by one of the new companies or whether it is an IPP, but there must be opportunities, and that is what the skills are looking for. Otherwise, they look for greener pastures.
Anyone still have a question? Is that okay for today? Fine. Well, Prof, thank you very much. Sir Jeffries, thank you very much for your input. Well said.
members, we will get a team to draft a report for your consideration for Tuesday morning at 10. Remember that the National Assembly would like to debate the bills on Wednesday, so we have to finish our work by Tuesday. But otherwise, we're done for today. Thank you very much. Before that,
sorry, can you just assist us? Are there going to be two separate votes, a debate on each bill in the House? Are you aware?
I don't know. Honourable Thomas, do you have an idea? Yes, maybe one vote.
Yes, Chair. The bills are going to be read, presented in terms of the other bill separation, but read together and debated at once.
It seems there will be one debate. Yeah. The time
we are trying to get that that back to us. And I was outside. I was trying to get that through to us, but programming now came on. As soon as we have it, Chair, I will relate it to all.
Okay, we'll relate the information as soon as we have it. Others are done. Have a good weekend. Thank you very much.
Coming to my middle way, you just sent your report. And probably the record.
Sorry?
Do you want to get it? Yes.
For me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll give it to the people at TNG.
Okay.
We can get it from them. And then the report
will
go on the website. But I can also send it to you.
Okay.
That's it.
Right, that's awesome.